Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the reality behind the news when we come back. The lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, your government is fully capable of making their own case against you without any help from you whatsoever. So don't give the prosecutor the victory. Make him work for it. Now, listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, or in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge in U.S. versus Dickerson said this. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights in U.S. versus Dickerson? The second judge in Belknap versus United States said, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. Belknap versus U.S. The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted, says Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now, or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page and you can download the free general law CD package right there. georgegordon.org, go to the archives page. The reality behind the news is something different than what we're viewing when we're watching Brian Williams and Katie Couric. And there's a thing in the news right now called the alternative minimum tax. And actually, it's the tax cuts, the George Bush tax cuts enacted back in 2003. Do you remember that? Well, those tax cuts are going to expire at the end of December 2010 and go back to their original percentages. And so the news says, my God, we have to get busy and pass this package or the taxes of the American people are going to go up. It'll be a tax increase in the middle of this recession and we can't have that. So the Republicans and the Democrats are pretty much agreed that we should continue these Bush tax cuts for at least two more years. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard this term before, but have you ever heard of AMT? Write it down. Write it down. We're going to learn something here. AMT. It's called the alternative minimum tax. It was enacted back in the Clinton years, I believe. Clinton years. And it was because they said that some taxpayers are so crafty about taking their deductions that they pay virtually no taxes. Now, I'll show you why there's so many of these tax deductions here. To prepare for tonight's program, I walked over to my library here, and I've got the U.S. code, and I counted up the number of volumes in Title 26. Now, Title 26 is the tax code of the United States. How many books do you think are in there? Well, the answer is 17. 17 volumes. And so I pulled out the last volume, number 17, and I flipped back quickly to the last page or so, and there was more than 800 pages in it. And then there's a supplement that fits in the back. It's got another 100 or 200 pages in it. I didn't count those. 17 volumes at 800 pages each. 17 times 800. That's 13,600 pages. That's right. 13,600 pages of tax law in the United States. There's much more than that. That's just between the hard bindings. There's a supplement that they put out every year for each one of those volumes, and it's got 100 pages or more in it. I'm telling you, there's a lot of material there. Now, I looked in the Bible to find out what the tax law in the Bible encompassed, and there are 17 statutes, that's right, 17 statutes, that fit comfortably on 4 8.5 by 11 pages. And it covers the entire tithing law. Now, there are three tithes in the Bible. It's first tithe, second tithe, and third tithe, in case you didn't know. Now you do. There's also seven annual holy day offerings. There is one cost, a tax, called the redemption of the firstborn. And then there is a one-time tax of one half shekel. It's called the temple tax. It's one half shekel. Every male pays it one time in his lifetime. The Jews and the Jewish rabbis, they're a little craftier. They make you pay it every year. It was a one time only. But, you know, churches have to make their money, and that's the way they do it. They lie to you and cheat you is what they do. Now, that's not very much material, four pages. Four pages compared to 17 volumes, 13,600 pages. But I bring that to your attention first. Now, going back to this alternative minimum tax, the purpose behind it was this. Ronald Reagan, in 1975, when he filed his tax returns, he had made over $1 million that year. And because of his investments and his investment strategies, he only paid $1,700 in taxes on his $1 million worth of income. As a result of that, in the 1976 presidential campaign, he lost that bid to unseat Gerald Ford, the president, to run against Jimmy Carter in 76. It was bandied about, hey, here's a millionaire, and he only pays $1,700. The average plumber pays more than that, which is true. So in the Carter years, the tax system was expanded. And then under the Ronald Reagan years, the spending and tax system was expanded again. And then a recession occurred about 1990 when George Bush Sr. was president. And then in 1992, Bill Clinton took over during a recession. You know, just like Barack Obama took over during a recession. Ronald Reagan took over during a recession. And the Clinton administration came up with a plan. They had a Democratic Congress and then a Democratic president. And so they said, well, here's what we ought to do. We should have an alternative minimum tax. And what that did to prevent a Ronald Reagan, who makes $1 million a year, from arranging his affairs so that he can only pay $1,700, when you get it down to that level, it triggers the alternative minimum tax, and here's the minimum tax, and you got to pay it. So you've got your 17 volumes, 13,000 pages of tax code, but if you're crafty and you use those 13,000 pages correctly, you may not owe very much tax. And so that cuts into government revenue. And they said, we need to solve that problem. And so the alternative minimum tax was actually a tax increase. And in fact, it did. It increased the total overall federal tax take by about 10%. So what it amounted to was a 10% tax increase. All right, so now time goes along and George Bush comes into office during a recession, 2000, 2001, 2002, remember? Now, George Bush wants to raise taxes, but if he comes to you and he says, I want to raise your taxes, that's not going to make you very happy. So what the Bush people did, they're very crafty people, they went to the Congress and they said, what we need is a big tax reduction. That's what everybody wants to hear, big tax reduction. And they called it the Bush tax cuts. So they went into the tax code, and then they changed the tax code so that you could take more deductions, and more of these deductions that you take, the lower your tax becomes until it makes you pay the alternative minimum tax. And if you get hit by the alternative minimum tax, you will pay more tax than you would have paid if you would have just paid the tax based upon the statutes and the rules that are in the books. Can you follow that? So there's been talk in the past of removing the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, because it's a cruel tax, because it's like inflation. It taxes people, it punishes people for their productivity and their following the law. If you follow the law and you're productive, you'll end up paying more taxes. Well, they never repealed the alternative minimum tax. They enacted the Bush tax cuts. And when they did that, federal revenue went up 10% more. You see, by lowering the taxes in the tax code, it triggered the AMT, which causes you to pay 10% more taxes than you would pay if you had followed the tax code. Isn't that special? That's deceptive. That's genius. My God, give them credit. Because everybody believes that those were tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts were really a tax increase of 10%. But if President Bush had come to you in 2001 and 2 and he said, well, I want to raise your taxes by 10%, you people would have gone berserk. But he didn't do that. He came to you and says, I want to give you a tax cut. You people loved him, voted him in a second time. But it actually cost you 10% more. So from the time the Bush tax cuts have been enacted, we have all been paying 10% more tax every year, paying the alternative minimum tax. Now, for some individuals, it may not have affected them much, if any, and in some cases, it affected them a whole bunch, and it was a hard hit. But I just wanted to let you know that the Bush tax cuts were not tax cuts. It was a tax increase. All right. So by cutting the taxes in the tax code, it triggered the AMT and raised your taxes 10%. So from 2001 or 2, whenever this was enacted, until last night at 5 o'clock, you have been paying 10% more tax. Now, if those taxes, the tax cuts of the George Bush era, were allowed to expire at the end of the year, then we would go back to the original tax code, and your taxes would go down by 10% because it would take you out of the alternative minimum tax. So you would be paying the regular income tax instead of the alternative minimum tax, and then you would pay 10% less. So the reality of it is, if you were to allow these Bush tax cuts to expire, your taxes, your tax bill, the total tax take of the federal government would actually go down 10%. Isn't that special? That's why I call that genius, because over in England, tonight I was watching the Lehrer News Hour, and the students over there, the British government's talking about raising taxes and cutting services, and there's people out in the streets, and they're rioting over there in the streets, throwing paintballs at Prince Charles's car, just raising hell with them. Well, okay. You see what happens when you raise people's taxes and cut their benefits? They get real mad. But if you give them a tax cut like George Bush, which actually takes 10% more of their money, they love you. And they fight over you. They just can't get enough of you. See how that works? All right. Now, in the Congress today, they're struggling with the Bush tax cuts, and they want to continue these tax cuts for the poor and the middle class. And the Democrats want to raise the taxes. So they want to keep the Bush tax cuts in place for the rich. Now that's a renvoi. You see, the Bush tax cuts are not a tax cut; they're a tax increase of 10%. So if you were to leave the Bush tax cuts in place for the middle class and the poor, the reality of that would be you continue the 10% tax increase that we've all been paying over the last 10 years. But by rescinding that for the rich, see, what would happen? We're going to continue the Bush tax cuts for the middle class and the poor, but we're going to take it away from the rich. Well, if you took it away from the rich, you would be lowering their taxes by 10%. Now, a guy by the name of George Orwell pointed that out in a book called 1984, and he called it doublespeak. Double speak. Up isn't up, up is down. Down is up, left is right is left. So it's actually the opposite of what you think, or the opposite of what you've been told, isn't it? Now, the Republicans are being branded as the party who's trying to continue the tax cuts for the rich, because they insisted that everybody get these tax cuts. So the Republicans are, in effect, saying everybody, rich, middle class, and poor, are going to continue on under the Bush tax cuts, which in reality is a 10% tax increase, remember? AMT comes in here. The Democrats say, no, let the Bush tax cuts expire for the rich and keep them on for the middle class and poor. So what they're really saying is, let's keep the 10% tax on the middle class and poor and take it off of the rich. Isn't that special? I thought you'd like that story. All right, so let me put an X right there. There's another story that I thought I'd bring up to you over here. Foreclosures, inflation and deflation. Ben Bernanke came on 60 Minutes the other night. You probably saw him. And he was defending his policies. And he said, we have to prevent deflation at all costs. We have to increase inflation. We've got to make more and more inflation so that we can keep the economy going. My God, we can't have deflation. That's what happened in the Depression. We had deflation. God, save us from deflation. All right. I don't know if Americans can think anymore. But let me ask you a question here. Last year, the price of gasoline, just to pick an item here that we all buy every day, last year the price of gasoline here where I'm at was about $2 a gallon, a little over, $2.20, something like that. Last night, coming home, I noticed the price of gas was $2.79, and that it was about, you know, pushing $2.80. So the price of gas has gone up from $2.20 to $2.80, so it's up 60 cents a gallon over last year. Ben Bernanke wants to protect me from deflation. So let me ask you this question. Would you rather pay $2.20 a gallon for gasoline or $2.80? I mean, if you had your druthers. If inflation is good, and that's what we need more of, would you like to see the price of gas go up to $3.80? It would seem like to me that if inflation's good for us and the price of gas went up 60 cents a gallon over the last year, wouldn't it be even better for us if it went up $1.60? Seems like to me that that would be the logical conclusion. Now, if I have to pay 60 cents more this year for gasoline than I did last year, and I've got one of those SUVs and it holds 35 gallons, and at $2.80, when you go to fill it up, it's about 30 gallons. And 30 gallons times $2.80 devastates a $100 bill. So when I go in to fuel up, it takes $100, round numbers, 80, 90, something like that. Now, last year, when I was paying $2.20, 2.20 times 30 gallons, about how much I put in, it cost me $66 to fill up my tank. So when I give the girl a $100 bill, she charges me $66, and I get $34 back. And now I can spend that $34 on something else, can't I? I could spend it on steak and potatoes, or I could spend it and maybe go out to the restaurant and take the wife, or, you know, I'd have $34 left over. Now, last night I noticed the price was $2.80. So we plug in $2.80 times 30 gallons, and it's $84. I give the girl the same $100 bill, and then she gives me back $16. Notice here that I'm short $16, you know, or thereabouts. 34, now I'm getting back 16, so I got $18 that I don't get. And so that's $18 less that I've got in my pocket to spend someplace else. Now remember, my friend Ben Bernanke, who's saving me, that's the American people, he's working for us now. Ben Bernanke is struggling mightily in the service of the American people. Let me ask you, would you rather put that $18 difference in your pocket or put it in the oil company's pocket? I mean, it's your choice. Well, maybe we don't have a choice, but you did when you voted the other day. It would seem like to me deflation is our friend and inflation is our enemy. Am I getting anywhere near right here? Frankly, if I had my druthers, I'd like to see the price of gasoline go down to $1 a gallon. I can remember when gasoline was 30 cents a gallon. Yep, I can remember 30 cents gas. The cheapest gas I ever saw in my lifetime was 24.9 cents in Ferndale, California in 1957. There was a gas war going on at that time. Two-bit gas was the norm. But if you look at 1950 to 1960, the price of gas was about 30 cents a gallon. Now, in those years, I made about $250 a month. That was $3,000 a year. And that wasn't bad wages. $3,000 a year was, you know, fair to middle. And taxes back in those days were a lot less than they are today. For instance, the tax rates ranged up as high as 91% because we adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And what that means is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy progressive income tax. And we Americans prefer the heavy progressive income tax. After all, we've been born and bred in America, and we're used to it, and we're taught and trained to practice that. And Americans want a heavy progressive income tax. I'm not quite sure why, but they do. And they have had opportunity to vote on that issue at least twice in the 1990s that I know of. And they voted it down both times. They said, we want the heavy progressive income tax. Now, I'm not here to argue with you people about income taxes. I just want to report to you on these numbers. And so if you got a pen and paper out here, let me give you the numbers. I'm going to show you how this works. Back in the 1950s, making $250 a month, I made $3,000 a year, and my taxes were about 10%. 2.6% of my tax was Social Security. That's $84 a year. And then the balance of that tax, you know, of about $300 a year is what I was paying in taxes, went to income tax. That left me with $2,700 left to buy gasoline. So with my $2,700 at 30 cents a gallon average price, that's 9,000 gallons of gas. So I had enough money every month to buy 9,000 gallons of gasoline. Not bad for a kid milking cows, huh? Well, now, today, prices are up 10 times. So today I make $30,000 a year, 10 times more money. And I'm in Fat City, and thank God for Ben Bernanke and the Democrats and all the communists and socialists. And they have taken over our economy, and they have inflated it. Inflated. We have inflation. And so today it takes $30,000 to buy what $3,000 would buy back in 1950. You know? So I'm getting my $30,000, but now I have to pay more tax. Instead of paying 2.6% Social Security tax, I now have to pay 16.1%. And now instead of paying 10% income tax, I have to pay 17% income tax. That's the new minimum now. So 16 and 17 is 33%. So I have to pay 33% of my $30,000. And that nets out to about $9,930, rounded off to $10,000. And I got $20,000 left over. Now, with my $20,000, let's just put it in the machine here, $20,000 divided by $3 a gallon, I can buy 6,666 gallons of gasoline. See, I got 9,000 gallons of gasoline back in 1955, but now I've got 6,666 gallons. So let's plug in our 9,000, and let's take 6,666. I lost 2,334 gallons of gas to inflation. And honest to God, boys and girls, do you think inflation is our friend, or do you think deflation is our friend? I don't want to argue with all these smart people with college degrees, but if you were to ask me, just a plumber on the street, if I'd rather have $3 a gallon gas or $2 a gallon gas, my vote is for $2. And that's deflation. I would like to see lots of deflation. And I wouldn't mind deflation in my pay scale either. Because if the price of rent went down and the price of gasoline went down and the price of my wages went down, I wouldn't be complaining. And I can tell you right now, I lived better on $3,000 a year in 1955 than I do today on $30,000 a year. And the people down in Silicon Valley are finding that out too, because they make $60,000 to $100,000 a year living in San Francisco, working in the computer industry in Silicon Valley. And here's what they find. If they take a pay cut to $10,000 a year and move to India, they can live in better digs, dress in better clothes, and have more spendable income in India to spend on themselves than they do in San Francisco at $100,000. Isn't that just real special? So by taking a pay cut of $50,000 a year, they live better on $10,000. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I don't want to dissuade you now from continuing your practice of the Communist Manifesto, and particularly that second plank, the heavy progressive income tax. But I wanted to point out to you that you have 2,334 gallons less gasoline every month practicing the Bush tax cuts. Isn't that just real special? Now, there's another big story in the news. It's called WikiLeaks. Have you been following this WikiLeaks story? There's a guy out here that's, he got hold of a bunch of unclassified material, you know, from the government. And he's been out here posting that on the internet. And Joel Skousen wrote a pretty scathing article here on WikiLeaks that we'll take up here when we come back. It's halfway time, so let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org and the archives page. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the reality behind the news. Now, there's news out there every night, and I was watching the news tonight with Brian Williams. God love him. And what I notice on the news is that it's really not so much news as it is information about all non-essential things. Like, there was a story on there about people with Parkinson's disease and how they were dancing at a New York studio, and the dancing in this New York studio helped them with their Parkinson's. And God love them, I hope those people get over their Parkinson's disease and have a lot of fun at the same time that they're dancing. But I fail to see that people with Parkinson's disease dancing at a dance studio in Brooklyn, New York is newsworthy. You know, it just doesn't strike me as being news. Now, when I get a report from Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran or North Korea and things like that, I take that as news. So when the North Koreans are bombarding South Korea, that strikes me as being newsworthy. And what I see on Brian and Katie is a lot of fluff, and it's nice stuff. And it sounds real good, makes me feel good. You know, when I get through listening to the news, I'm not worried about North Korea because I'm thinking about people with Parkinson's disease that are dancing in the studio. But I think that it's more important for me to know about what the North Koreans are doing. Now, the other day, there's a guy from Australia, and he got hold of some classified information. And he's been publishing that on the internet. Well, Joel Skousen, who publishes World Affairs Brief, had a little comment about that. And he said, here's what we can learn from the latest WikiLeaks. And I thought, well, now this, I think, is newsworthy. I think this is something that all of us ought to pay attention to, and let's see if there's some reality here behind the news. Well, what we can learn from the latest WikiLeaks, the leak of a 250,000 U.S. diplomatic messages has left a trail of embarrassment around Hillary Clinton's State Department and sparked a witch hunt for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, now on Interpol's most wanted red list. While the cables contain some candid and insulting remarks about world leaders, there is a strange lack of anything really sensitive or substantive, leading me to believe that these leaks have been pre-filtered, that they aren't a dump of all cables from a certain time period. The government's claim that the release of these cables puts lives at risk is also a troubling overreaction that may well be used to justify a draconian crackdown on whistleblowers and on the internet in general. So there's the first paragraph, and I read that and I said, oh, that makes sense. Now that's real news. What we're dealing with here is the WikiLeaks leaks, and so here's the Secretary of State, and she's clamoring and she's saying, well, this is a terrible crime. Let me give you an illustration. You remember that $1 trillion that the government gave to all the banks? Your money, tax dollar, taxpayer money, gave it to the banks because these banks now were going broke, and they said, well, we got to have this money or the economy is going to collapse. And so the Congress got busy and they enacted this TARP program, and George Bush was in on it, and those, Barack Obama and Congress and Nancy and Harry and everybody. And then there was an attempt on the part of the Congress and on the part of some other private people, like Bloomberg, for instance, Bloomberg News. They wanted to know, well, what did the banks do with that money? And the banks, there's a lawsuit going on right now. And I think it's Bloomberg that's suing. And they said, we want to know, well, what did these banks do with that money? And guess what? It's been declared to be top secret and we can't know. Well, isn't that just real special? And I got to thinking about, well, how many American soldiers in Afghanistan's lives now are at risk if the Bank of America were to tell us how much of that they gave to their CEO and their CFO and so on as bonuses, you know, for their malfeasance in office. See where we're going with this? See, all the government needs to do is to put a top secret on there, and they got laws to protect top secret information. Well, now, I'm going to read you a couple, three of these top secret, you know, now that they've been published. And then I'm going to come back and ask you, well, what in the hell do you think is so top secret about that? Here's a story. It comes out from The Guardian. Here's a revelation that came out, and it was published in The Guardian. So The Guardian read WikiLeaks, and they published it. Well, now, if you're going to take this guy, Assange, and you're going to lock him up for espionage, shouldn't you lock up the publishers of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian for publishing the same stuff? Well, anyway, remember what Skousen says. He said there's a total lack of anything substantive here. Here's the first one. It says, Russia is a virtual mafia state with rampant corruption and scant separation between the activities of the government and organized crime. Vladimir Putin is accused of amassing illicit proceeds from his time in office, which various sources allege are hidden overseas. And he has was likely to have known about the operation in London to murder the Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko. Now, that's one of the top secret cables that somebody sent to the State Department that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said is a threat to the national security of the United States. In reading that, it sounds more like gossip to me. What evidence do you have that Vladimir Putin has been illegally taking money, or that he's squirreling it away in Swiss banks or overseas or someplace else? I mean, it's probably true. I'm not discounting the fact that he's probably a crook. But that's not evidence. That is the American ambassador or somebody working in the embassy over there sending a cable back to the United States, encrypted, top secret, and it's put in the files. And this guy, Assange, has put it out here on the internet and said, here's what our State Department is telling, here's what our ambassador in Moscow is telling the State Department. I mean, if you published that and you told a farmer in Kansas, did you know that Vladimir Putin is squirreling money away in Swiss Bank? Can anybody out there send me an email and explain to me how this endangers national security, or how that is going to endanger our troops in Afghanistan? But if the government can propagandize us into believing that these WikiLeaks leaks are a disgrace and it's a threat to national security, and as a result of that, we're going to have to put censorship on the internet. Hey, wouldn't that affect us all? See, here's what they did in the airports. This whole story about terrorism is as phony as a $3 Fed note. You know it, and I know it. But look at what they've been able to do. They got the Patriot Act passed. They got Homeland Security passed. And then now, when you go to the airport, you have to take off your shoes. Can't carry a bottle of water on the airplane with you. And now they want to x-ray you, and now they want to stick a probe up your anus. Isn't that special? Well, if you want to go through that, go ahead. But it'll be a cold day in hell before I ever go into an airport. I mean, United Airlines can take all their airplanes and stick them up their anuses sideways. Sideways. Before I go out and spend $1 with them. Maybe even 10 cents. They'll all go bankrupt waiting for me to spend money. Now, one of these days, somebody's going to walk into a Walmart store and blow himself up. And then you're going to have a pass to get into a Walmart store. See what they're doing here? So what they do is they create these crimes. If you're watching the TV, the FBI created an entrapment crime in Portland. The other day, they created another one. I forgot where it was now. Two. They got two of them underway. These terrorist events are staged events by the FBI. They go out and find some dumb 19-year-old teenage kid that's having fantasy problems and persuade him that he should practice jihad because he's probably going to a Muslim mosque. And then they furnish him with barrels and barrels of stuff that he thinks are explosives. And he works real hard to build a bomb. He more than likely would love to build a bomb. But oven by himself, without the help of the FBI and his coaches and his mentors, he wouldn't know how to do it. You know? So that's why I'm telling you, they're as phony as a $3 bill. Now, there's a bunch of these cables that have been published here in The Guardian. Here's one. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has been sheltering the leader of the nationalist insurgency in Pakistan's province for years. And then there was another story over here. Anyone with an IQ superior to 75 might have suspected by now that the United States diplomats spy on their United Nations colleagues under Clinton's orders, and of course UN diplomats do a lot of spying on the United States, especially Russia and China, that Washington conducted a bazaar to force small countries to accept Guantanamo inmates, that the Pakistani military intelligence ISI, the establishment is intertwined with the Taliban, which means that the U.S., which controls the ISI, is likewise knowing of this involvement. Now listen, this war in Afghanistan is as phony as the war in Korea. Now let's think about this for a minute. Think about this. In World War II, when we were fighting the Nazis, and let's suppose that the Nazis, that is the Germans, now they had an army, and they stuck their army over here in Luxembourg. And as long as the Germans are in Luxembourg, we can't attack them there because that's sovereign territory. Huh? Wherever they were, it didn't make any difference if they were in Luxembourg or Belgium or France. We hunted them down, killed them. The objective in World War II was to win the war. The objective in Afghanistan isn't to win the war. If the United States, with all of our military power, wanted to eliminate the Taliban, and we applied all of the military force that America has at its disposal, I doubt if that war could legitimately last 30 days. The American army would go into Pakistan and clean that rat's nest out, and that would be the end of it. The only thing that keeps it going, 90% of the war in Afghanistan comes from those provinces in Pakistan that are next to the Afghan border. 90% of all the fighting is right there on the border. If you went across the border and wiped them out, that'd be the end of the war. But we don't want an end to the war. I mean, if the government wanted an end to the war, they would have ended it. I find this impossible to believe. The United States of America could defeat Japan and Germany simultaneously in 3.5 years, and we can't defeat a bunch of ragheads running around in the desert with Toyota pickups in 9 years? You've got to be kidding me. That's not a superpower. Hell, I think if you were to turn 500 good men loose over there and tell them go get them, I think they'd wipe them out. Got a Marine here in class one time. And I asked him, I said, now, you're trained in the military and all. And I said, let's suppose that you have a company of men, that's about 100 men, and you're defending a silo over here. And you have 10,000 citizens armed with 30-06s, hunting rifles and deer rifles, 10,000 against 100. And then I said, now, you're going to defend this, and they're going to take this grain away from you, but you're going to defend this silo. I said, could you do that? And he said, well, what kind of support do we have? And I said, well, what would you normally have? And he said, well, we would normally have air support to back us up. And he said, now, if we had air support, 100 men could stand off 10,000 citizens like a shot. Then he said, do we have any armor, artillery, or... And I said, I don't know. What do you normally have? He said, well, you know, if we're just talking about 100 men and all we've got is small arms, he said, they probably could overrun us if they wanted to, if they could stick in the fight. But he said, no, if we had support, you know, normal support, a company of men could do that. Now, here we are over there with, I don't know, 165,000 U.S. soldiers, and there's a bunch of NATO soldiers over there, too. And then they report to us we're losing the war over there. You know, losing the war. Here's the superpower, the world's only superpower over here, and we were able to defeat Japan and Germany simultaneously in 3.5 years, and we can't take on a bunch of ragheads. Well, not as long as you tie our hands behind our backs and you let them hide over on the other side and we can't go over there and get them. So they sneak across the border and shoot 5 of our guys and then run back. Now, they can keep that kind of war going on for 1,000 years, but if you ever turned the American army loose on those guys over there, they'd be home for Christmas. So I just thought I'd point that out. There isn't anything here that I saw in this report that you could legitimately say is a threat to any soldier, but it's a threat to you and I. And the powers that be don't like the Internet. That Internet over there, it distributes too much information. So you can tune into a program like mine or anybody else, and then they can tell you. This WikiLeaks guy over here, he's giving you a lot of information that's been branded top secret, but there isn't any secrets there. There isn't anything that's really worth hiding, not anything that I've seen. And here in the newsletter, this is called World Affairs Brief, he's probably got 25 or 30 examples. And he comes over here and he says, this guy is the messenger. And so what these guys are talking about here is attacking the messenger, Julian Assange. This Washington blog.com was astounded that the Department of Justice has launched a criminal probe of WikiLeaks, that Assange may face espionage charges, and that Representative Peter King is asking that WikiLeaks be designated a foreign terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda. And do you think that's incredible? Well, some have called for Assange's assassination, and WikiLeaks' website is under attack by hackers who think they're doing their patriotic duty. And even worse, I fear that this attack, the messenger mentality, will hand the government an excuse to label whistleblowers as criminals rather than protect them, as if government has ever protected a whistleblower. A true whistleblower would have only leaked evidence of wrongdoing and would not have done wholesale leaks. In my opinion, these have clearly been filtered. None of the typical dirty tricks, such as plans to undermine or overthrow governments, have been revealed. So they appear to be a conscious effort to give the government an excuse to crack down on the Internet. So tuck that one away in your heart, and let's watch and see if that's what they actually do. These personal attacks on WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is really strange. The Swedish rape charge first surfaced a few months ago, but was immediately dismissed by a Swedish prosecutor as baseless. Then the charge was resurrected again without any reason other than the obvious. The establishment wanted this guy shut down and had leaned on Sweden to drum up the charge again. One of the women coming forth with the rape charge admits that she had consensual sex with Assange, but that the condom broke and he refused to stop, thus becoming rape. Now, I'm going to pause right there. You know, boys and girls, hey, wait a minute. Hey, hang on a second. I mean, anybody above the age of 21, married and had a couple of kids over here, could look at that sentence right there and say, well, that's as stupid as anything I've ever heard. Excuse me, when was the last time you were having sex with a condom and you said, oh my God, it broke, we have to stop and start over? Huh? Let's wake up and smell the coffee. That's stupid on its face. Nobody has ever found out that the condom broke until after they were finished. For that woman to say, whoop, whoop, stop, stop, the condom broke. Come on. Let's grow up and be adults, shall we? And this is all the better they can do. Now, the charges have been revised to state that Assange was guilty of having sex without a condom based on an obscure Swedish law. What's really going to happen is that this will be used as the excuse to arrest Assange, and then the U.S. will charge him with being an accessory to espionage and then file extradition papers. Now, as I report this to you, that's already happened. He's in jail as I speak. Now, I really don't know if this guy is for real or if he's a CIA plant. WikiLeaks has all of the telltale signs of a too-good-to-be-true startup with millions of dollars to fund it, kind of like Google with its mysterious seed money from the NSA and other intelligence agencies. And something else just came up. WikiLeaks has been forced off of 2 major servers due to government pressure. Now, WikiLeaks has moved to a fortified data center in Sweden called the Bahnhof, a Cold War underground bunker for trains that is now a high-security data center. This was necessary after Amazon.com bowed to government pressure and kicked WikiLeaks off of their servers. But I can't help but wonder why the Swedish government, supposedly trying to arrest Assange, would allow the Bahnhof to host his website. Now, that sounds like Osama bin Laden. Remember, Osama bin Laden went in and had surgery over in Bahrain or Qatar or someplace. And while he was in the hospital, he was met by CIA agents. Osama bin Laden is a CIA agent. Nobody arrested him when he was right there in the hospital. Did you notice that? Okay, and this Google thing over here. You know, the CIA creates businesses and institutions that they run, they own. It's called black ops. Black ops. I don't know that Google is one of their black ops, but we've seen reports in the past that they do that pretty regularly. And then as an offshoot of that, they have access to all of the information that comes through it. So this all looks like a government setup to me to make the case that revealing such innocuous, in this case, you know, innocuous cables such as these should be considered treason. Representative Ron Paul is the first in Congress to stand up against this nonsense. In an interview with Fox Business, Paul said the idea of prosecuting Assange crosses the line, Paul said. In a society where truth becomes treason, then we're in big trouble. And now people who are revealing the truth are getting into trouble for it. Do you remember back in 1972 or 3, a guy by the name of Daniel Ellsberg released a bunch of Pentagon papers, told the truth about the Vietnam War? Excuse me, boys and girls, but when there's corruption going on in government and somebody blows the whistle, what's wrong with that? Well, it's a criminal mentality that says, wait a minute, this guy's a whistleblower. In prison, they call them stool pigeons, snitches, and they kill them. Government's doing the same thing. When they find a whistleblower, they don't call him, you know, a stool pigeon or a snitch. They call him a whistleblower, and then they isolate the guy. And then they fire him. They ostracize him here in government. Every time you find a whistleblower who exposes government corruption and misconduct, happens to them every time. That's why you don't find very many people in government blowing the whistle on the corruption that goes on. Government's corrupt. And as a result of that, the people that work for the government keep their mouth shut, and the corruption multiplies. Well, I just thought that we would take a look at the reality behind the news. Let me give you the name and number for this guy again. This is called the World Affairs Brief. I don't have the number right in the face of this one. The other day I gave you his email address, and then on this one I don't have it. Not special. I'll do a Google search on it, look for World Affairs Brief, and the guy's name is Joel M. Skousen. This is the December 3, 2010 edition. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.